American Insurance versus Dish Network, 171140. Counsel, we're ready to hear you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Eric Shumsky, and I represent Dish Network. I'd like to try to simplify things a little bit, because for the decision below to be overturned, really only two things have to be true. First, that some of the damages alleged in the underlying complaint are covered by the policies, and second, that some of those damages aren't barred as a matter of public policy. Let me take each of those two things in turn. First, as to the damages under the policy. The damages sought against Dish under the TCPA are damages that the TCPA itself calls damages, and they are damages within the meaning of the policies. Not only does the underlying TCPA complaint actually allege actual damage, in addition, the TCPA's provision for $500 in liquidated statutory damages clearly includes a compensatory or remedial component. Five appellate courts.
Why don't we get to a couple of issues in your case that seem to be troubling, and then we need to get over to give you any relief that you would have us extend. And that is, the district court concluded that this Dish Network versus Arrowwood indemnity case controlled the determination of whether you are a telecasting company under the Act. So why don't you address that first?
Certainly, Your Honor.
How do you get around the previous case? This is a 2014 case. So declaring you.
Yes, Your Honor. I want to say two things about that. First, just to be clear about stage setting here, that applies only to coverage B. And so even if the court disagrees with us about that, we're still in the game on coverage A. On coverage B, the simple fact of the matter is this. Arrowwood was not interpreting these policies. This is a matter of contract interpretation, and the contracts before the court in Arrowwood were different contracts, and they were different in the following critical respect. In those contracts, the codes that are on the front page of every single one of the policies at issue here, and we've put them in the record at pages 2059 to 2120, those codes were outside of the four corners of the relevant policies. And the court said to Dish, look, we can't bring those into the policies. They're not enough to create ambiguity, but here they're already in the policies. ACE had the ability, when it wrote these policies, on each of those declaration pages to classify Dish how it wanted to. There was actually one of those codes for broadcasters. That's in the record. It's code 4832. It's at page 2195 of the appendix. And that's not what is on these particular policies. In addition, each one of these declaration pages specifies what's referred to as the business of the insured. Again, that's different from the Arrowwood policies. And again, ACE, which wrote the policies and was filling out these declaration pages, could have said, Dish, you're a broadcaster, but it didn't. It said that Dish is cable and other paid television services. That's the 2004 to 2006 policies, paid television provider, 2007 to 2008, and elsewhere.
So your argument is that the policies control over what you are, whether you are or are not a telecommunication company.
Yes, Your Honor, and to put even a finer point on it, the question is whether there's even ambiguity about that question.
And the other concern that I'd like you to address specifically, and then make sure that we don't miss these two points in the context, is the general rule has always been that you can't insure against your own, when I say you, I don't mean it in that context, but your own misdeeds. For example, you can't deduct penalties under the Internal Revenue Code for as ordinary business and necessary business expenses, and there's all kinds of cases all across the country declaring penalties as not being compensable. You seem to be swimming against a stream on that point. So if you'd address that as well.
Thank you, Judge Lucero. So I think actually the current is very much with us here, and let me explain why.
Right.
The Colorado Supreme Court has laid out a pretty simple test for when something is uninsurable as a matter of public policy. The relevant cases are Lira and Borer, and in those cases...
What about Cruz?
So Cruz is not a public policy case. The Colorado courts have never used Cruz for that purpose, and this court shouldn't be the first to extend it in that way. The test under Lira and Borer is whether the conduct was intentional or willful. That's language in Borer at 1262. Elsewhere, on the same page, Borer talks about harmful, wanton, or malicious acts. That's the relevant test here. If you want to look at Lira, Lira talks about punitive damages. And so, Judge McHugh, to turn back to the Cruz case.
In that case, the Colorado Supreme Court, and I think 2008, so relatively recently, held that TCPA payments were damages, were in fact a penalty, didn't it?
It held that they were a penal within a particular meaning of Colorado law. Again, it was not applying this public policy exception. And let me try and explain to you why the Cruz case cannot be the proper inquiry here. Leave aside for the moment the fact that, again, it's not a public policy case, and Lira and Borer actually established the right test.
Before you go on, I mean, isn't this an inconsistent position for Dish? In Warnock, didn't Dish take the absolute opposite position as to whether these TCPA damages were penalties?
Sorry, in which case, Your Honor? I didn't hear.
Warnock versus Dish Network?
I don't recall the precise position that Your Honor is referring to there. The other side has accused us of speaking out of both sides of our mouth in the underlying litigation here. And the arguments there were very different. Those were particular arguments related to, for instance, things like vicarious liability or excessiveness under the due process clause. But again, really what's at issue here is this question about uninsurability. Mm-hmm. So I want to try and make two points about this that I think are absolutely critical.
Really
first,
more non-insurability than uninsurability, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
Judge McHugh, I want to try and finish making the Cruz point because I think that this is really essential here. The other side has relied on Cruz, and they have this simple syllogism at the beginning of their brief, and they say, well, you put together Cruz and Lira and Dish loses. The Cruz test cannot apply here because it provides absolutely backwards results.
Why don't you talk about what these payments are so that we can determine as a matter of fact whether they look more like a duck or they look more like a chicken? Describe these payments.
Certainly, Your Honor. And this goes to the point that I started with the five separate appellate courts, and we cite them at pages 13 or at footnotes 13 and 15 of our opening brief. Five separate appellate courts have looked at this question, and each of those courts, each court to consider this question, has concluded that the $500 in fact contain or amount to liquidated statutory damages. The language of the Eighth Circuit in the Universal Underwriters case is that they are, quote, or that a portion of the fixed amount represents a liquid.
Like you're still talking conclusory language instead of descriptive language. What are the payments for?
Your Honor, they are.
How are they incurred? How are they triggered?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, just to make sure I understand the question.
I mean, these things that I call penalties, you say aren't penalties. What were the payments for?
I see, Your Honor. So they are liquidated statutory damages to compensate for the alleged wrong of violating the TCPA.
So they're triggered by a violation of the Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, is the violation, describe the violation of the Act. Is it more of a punitive nature? Or is it more of an accounting nature, or what is the act?
I see, Your Honor. And this is perhaps the fundamental point under Lira and Borer. The TCPA is...
You're from Philadelphia, right?
I'm from Washington, D.C.
All right, let's talk to you. But you're in the West now, so when we see something, we describe it factually instead of legally. So describe it for me factually.
Certainly, Your Honor. These are a damages award for wrongfully calling someone, either using robocalling or in violation of a do not call list, and they are strict liability. They are not. There is no requirement of willfulness.
You don't have to prove the amount of damages. You don't have to prove anything. All you do is prove it happened, and bingo, it's $500.
Well, there are two separate ways of doing it. So, first of all, you can actually prove actual damage. And as we've argued in the papers, we think that the complaint here, under the notice standard that applies, remember, we're just talking about the duty to defend here,
right,
that certainly the complaint can be fairly read as alleging actual damage. But separately, with regard to the $500 that I think Your Honor is referring to, they are, and let me try and get out this quote from the Eighth Circuit, because I do think it actually answers Your Honor's question.
Mm-hmm.
They represent a liquidated sum for uncertain and hard to quantify actual damages. They're a shortcut. It may be hard for someone to prove, yeah, it harmed me in the amount of $5 or $100 or $250 when you robocalled me.
So
Congress provided a shortcut.
So you have Joe Sixpack watching the Super Bowl, and that's pretty extreme because you wouldn't do a robocall on Super Bowl theoretically, but you got him watching a football game on watching the Broncos, and the phone rings. And it's a bloody robocall. Oops, sorry, I'm going to drop my earplug. Let me put my earplug in, says the person who's calling. He said, when you know that isn't true at all. So this robocall comes in, and now Joe calls the no-call list, said, I was on the no-call list, and they called me, and they said, well, how much were you damaged? Let's see, I had to walk from the TV room to the kitchen. He can't prove it's 10 cents, 50 cents. So the statute says $500 for calling Joe, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It is meant to take the place of the proof of actual damages.
And the question
for us,
is that $500 a penalty or is it liquidated damages?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And
it says that if it's liquidated damages, that it doesn't have any of the look like duck qualities of a penalty.
I see that I'm getting short on time, Your Honor. I want to fight the premise in the following critical way.
Okay.
The question is not whether it's a penalty.
Uh-huh.
The question is whether it is uninsurable as a matter of public policy, and that is the work that Lira and Borer do. The question of whether something is a penalty, Judge McHugh, I don't want to interrupt. It looked like you were about to ask a question.
Are we bound by the allegation and complaint that these were willful and knowing violations?
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, that is not the sole allegation here. And remember, I cannot emphasize this strongly enough. We are only talking about the duty to defend here. We were poured out at summary judgment on the threshold question of whether there even potentially could be any claim that even theoretically, in the language of the Colorado Supreme Court in Compass, might be insurable. And so, Your Honor, to the extent that there were damages that were, or to the extent that there was willfulness, and just as an aside, the case has gone to verdict, and there was not actually willfulness found. But even if it were, the only question here is ex ante when the complaint is filed. Was there potentially a compensable harm or an insurable harm? If I can, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is John Hacker for Appellee Ace. I'll start, if I may, where Judge Lucero started and just go through the argument in the same way the Court has already taken us on the Arrowwood point in coverage B, which I only agree is only part of the case. Arrowwood answers literally every question, rejects every argument they make except one, which Mr. Chomsky addressed, which is that the policy here differs because of the codes and the declarations. Look at page 9 of their brief when they tell us what the codes are. One of the codes is radio and television broadcasting and communications equipment. The word broadcasting is right there. That's what DISH is. They're not a kitchenware company. The DISH that they give you is the equipment to receive the DISH broadcast, as they themselves in their own documents say over and over again. Reason is the soul of all law. We're reminded by this courtroom it would be beyond reason to say that DISH, when it describes itself as a broadcaster, is not actually a broadcaster. The declarations are to similar effect. It doesn't use the word broadcaster, but the declarations that they rely on say communications, cable and other pay television services. Remember that the exclusion is for broadcasting and telecasting. What's a television service but telecasting? Paid television provider. None of those are inconsistent with them being a broadcaster. They're perfectly consistent, just different ways of saying the business that DISH is in, all of which encompass broadcasting. There's no real doubt that under Arrowood and the plain language of this policy, coverage B is inapplicable. So let's turn to the argument on damages, which actually encompasses both coverage A and coverage B. If these are non-insurable damages, there isn't coverage under either provision, and they decidedly are not insurable damages.
Let me ask you about that. I look at that statute, and I see a punitive damages proportion, which would clearly, in my view, be something that you shouldn't be able to insure. But then it has another provision that seems to be liquidated damages because of the difficulty that Judge Lucero illustrated of trying to prove how you're harmed. They're annoying, but it's hard to quantify the harm. Doesn't that suggest that there is a punitive aspect here, but not all the damages under the statute are punitive or uninsurable?
With respect, no, Your Honor. Cruz answers that. I mean, Cruz tells us that it's not the kind of provision that DISH wants it to be. But to your precise point on the punitive damages, clearly the punitive damages apply when there's the willful, intentional aspect. All that does is double or treble the amount that you can obtain. That doesn't mean that the other provision isn't a penal provision, as Cruz already says. I mean, Cruz answers this question. There's no ambiguity about that. Cruz tells us that as a matter of Colorado law, the statutory damages provision is penal. And it uses, and I want to be clear, it's not about the word damages. Cruz itself calls it a liquidated damages provision. It is a liquidated damages provision, but going back to the common law, that doesn't answer the question as to whether or not something is penal. There has to be more work done, including under contracts. Cruz itself, in a footnote, refers to the fact that we have a different test for deciding whether contractual liquidated damages provision is penal. Well, the same thing went on in Cruz. Cruz applied a new three-part test under Colorado law to determine whether the TCPA inflicts a penalty. And the Cruz already told us that the answer is yes. First of all, is it a new and distinct cause of action? Yes. Second of all, do you need proof of actual loss? Or you don't need to prove actual loss? And the court said, yes, that's true there. And third, will the award normally exceed actual loss? And that's the key here.
I like the argument that you made because it highlights one point, and that is your use of the word treble damages. And that, I think, cuts against you. And that is that, is this more like the damages that are doubled, or even though we would know compensatory damages would be relatively nominal, because they're hard to fix, the court could, as counsel argues, just say, well, we're not going to be able to get into a dispute about the amount of damage, so we're just going to arbitrarily set $500 as the penalty. But if it's accompanied with malice or whatever in the punitive damage context, we're going to double damages. This isn't a case where the damages are doubled, so we don't have that type of punitive behavior determination. What distinguishes this case from the punitive case that requires us to conclude that this is a penalty?
I think Cruz answered that question, particularly the third element of Cruz. That's what it's getting at. The third element of Cruz is whether or not the award will like almost always exceed the actual loss. What that factor is doing is determining whether or not the relevant legislative body was basically doing an estimate. It's hard to tell. Just like under the contract law, that's what Colorado law does the same well. If they said $5, this would be a different kind of case. $10, maybe a couple triggers, if you had 10 calls, we'll say it's $50. But what Cruz says, again, Cruz already answered all this. What Cruz says is, under that third provision, there's absolutely no connection between the $500 amount and the guy walking from his television to the phone and saying, well, I don't want it, hanging up. There's no evidence or basis for inferring whatsoever that Congress decided the $500 was a rough approximation of actual loss. And the inference that Cruz, again, already drew from that is that the $500 is used to punish and deter just the fact of the violation. That's why the second element is so relevant, because what it does is, with the violation, to get the $500 liquidated damages, you don't have to prove anything else. Just the fact that a call was made when it shouldn't have been made, you don't have to talk about your own loss in any respect. And that's what happened here.
Cruz was looking at it in terms of whether or not it was assignable, right? I mean, that was the specific purpose of the analysis in Cruz. If we were to limit Cruz to that purpose, the trend outside of Colorado seems pretty clearly to be in favor of saying that these are insurable, these TCPA payments. Would you agree?
I think that has been the trend. I don't question that, because they're applying a different test, which is this test of the assumption that it's hard to tell what, you know, your damages is. So that's what the $500 is doing, and there's incorporates an element of compensation. But Cruz is a quite different test, and it's not, by its terms, limited to assignment. Indeed, it already on its face draws or applies the same rule from the limitations context in analyzing assignment. It draws from the survivor rules. So already Cruz is applying in three different areas of Colorado law, and not one.
Colorado law apply at all. I mean, these robocalls, irrespective of who makes them, they don't generally distinguish by state line. They typically cut across the country, I presume. Why should we have a rule that the call received in Colorado is a penalty, but the call received in Connecticut is not, and the call received in Philadelphia or D.C. or wherever is, it's a crazy quilt.
Right.
Why should we look at,
because
given that it's a federal statute, why should we look at a state determination on point?
Because what we're trying to do is decide whether, as a matter of Colorado law, this is the kind of damage that can be insured. That's a pure Colorado law question. And so Colorado law asked the question, again, about the federal law for purposes of assignment, adopted what is clearly a general test under Colorado law for determining whether this federal statute is a penalty for purposes of assignment. The same argument principle would have applied there. The court could have said it's a federal law, so we come up with a federal approach. But that's not what the Colorado Supreme Court did, and correctly, because that was a state law question. So too here, we're dealing with a state law question of whether this kind of claim can be insured, and that is
only because it arises in an insurance context.
That's correct. I mean, I think it would apply in any context in which, as a matter of state law, the rule of decision turned on whether the TCPA was penal or not. It doesn't always come up as a matter of state law, but here it has. And Cruz, and we're not even, you know, reading by analogy, like some other statute that, you know, the Cruz court addressed. Cruz addressed the TCPA and said it's penal under Colorado law. That has to be applied here. And then when you apply it, it's correct that there's a syllogism. When you apply it under LIRA, LIRA tells us it can't be insured under Colorado law. And I just want to address that point, because Dish argues that the Colorado principle is only based on intentional conduct, that that's what's not insurable. That's completely at odds with LIRA, which isn't even cited in their opening brief, even though that's the case the district court relied on, because I think they can't escape what LIRA says. LIRA doesn't talk about intentional conduct being the problem. What LIRA says is the problem is you don't want to relieve the wrongdoer of the consequences of their action that the relevant sanction is trying to discourage. Here's what LIRA says.
In that context, and that's why I made the distinction earlier, that if a car is going down the road with one wheel that's badly worn and two wheels that are smoking, that's an uninsurable risk. Or a ship going in the ocean, it's not seaworthy, it's uninsurable. But that doesn't necessarily mean you can't insure it if some underwriter's crazy enough to write the policy. Whereas a penalty cannot be insured, it is non-insurable. That is, the distinction that I was making.
And that distinction is exactly correct. I will say that there are cases that refer to the fact that you could insure it even if you want to, or intentional conduct, you could insure it if you want to. But that's what's really going on here is the fact that Lira says, and it's just reaffirming prior cases, that say you don't want to relieve the wrongdoer of the sanction that the legislature or the regulatory body has imposed to deter that wrongdoer and other people from doing the same thing. It refers to the Tenery case is the one that it pulls forward. In that case, it talks about a wrong against the public. And then it goes on at length to discuss the Soto case in New York, and it quotes the Soto court saying, relying on the fundamental principle that no one shall be permitted to take advantage of his own wrong. That's the principle. It's not about intentional misconduct, and that's what the court is applying in Lira, and that's the principle that applies here. If there are no other questions on that damages point or on coverage B, I would just...
Can you answer a question for me? I'm really confused. On coverage A, it has to be an occurrence. On coverage B, does it have to be an occurrence also?
No, that is not occurrence-based coverage. That's a difference. And I'm going to get to the occurrence argument now, but the damages argument does apply to both because it has to be insurable damages. One other point I would make on the complaints here, it's just worth reminding, the district court relied on this too. These were governments suing. These were not individuals even trying to assert that they'd suffered some kind of loss. These were governments trying to enforce a public statute. The district court correctly said what's going on here is the court was using the TCPA liquidated damages penalty as a, quote, cudgel to induce compliance. That's not about compensation in any respect. It's to induce compliance, and that's the kind of thing that can't be insured. Let me just say, if I may, a word about the occurrence issue.
One quick question. Was Universal Underwriters, that Eighth Circuit case, decided under federal law or state law?
Is that the Lou Fuzz case?
The Lou Fuzz case.
I can't remember. I mean, it sounds like it was Universal Insurance. Universal Underwriters, it was an insurance case, which would tell us it was a matter of state law. But it was decided before Cruz and applied a different approach.
But it's contrary to Cruz.
Well, except it's a different test is applied. I don't know what the Eighth Circuit would have said if it applied the Cruz three-part way for analyzing whether TCPA is a penal statute. The occurrence issue is worth addressing, though, because it's also completely dispositive of coverage A. A majority of jurisdictions say and hold that TCPA claims arise from an intentional act, which is not an occurrence. An occurrence is an accident, which does not encompass the intentional act itself or the natural and probable consequences of the intentional act. That's the test. And it's quite clear that calls are intentional, and any harm that they try to point to, even in a general sense, the harm that the person has to stand up and go pick up the phone and the phone is being used, all of that's the whole point of the call. So, of course, those consequences are intended.
But in Park University, we said the distinction is between whether you intended to injure versus whether you intended to make the robocalls.
And then later in 2015, this court in Amasco very much narrowed Park Enterprise and said Park Enterprises is a quite unique case because in that case the insured had thought it had a specific invitation, a solicitation, an approval from the callee, if you will, to accept the facts, and that if there was it was just a mistake. If there was any liability, it was a mistake and a misunderstanding. That's what Amasco says was going on at Park Enterprises, and then Amasco otherwise joins the majority of jurisdictions and says that it says a bare mistake isn't going to be enough, that possibility, because rather what matters is whether or not the call was intentional, and then you just know that if you're going to make a call intentionally, of course they're going to pick up the phone. Somebody can't sue and then say, just because the violation wasn't intended. That's really their argument. You won't find a case, I don't think, out there saying that, for example, if somebody dumps some sort of toxic material and then says, well, I didn't realize that it was toxic, that was not an intentional act and an insurable. That's the same kind of situation we have here. Thank you very much.
Your Honors, I think this discussion actually narrows things quite a bit, and in the short time I have left, I want to try to get right to what's left here. They agree that the trend is against them, and to be clear, Judge McHugh, that's an extraordinary understatement. The unanimous trend is against them. They live and die on Cruz here. And I want to explain in my 1 minute the two examples, the two things that prove beyond all doubt that Cruz cannot be the test here. First, under Cruz, punitive damages aren't penal. Let me repeat that. Under Cruz, punitive damages, the very thing that Lira says is uninsurable as a matter of Colorado public policy, they are treated as non-penal. Cruz relies on Palmer versus A.H. Robbins, and Palmer says that in absolutely plain terms. The reason for that is the first prong of the Cruz test, which is that you have to have a separate cause of action, and that proves the point. It is a test that has nothing whatsoever to do with insurability, and that gets to the second reason that Cruz cannot be the test here. Under the Cruz test, it gives you absolutely backwards results in the insurance context. It tells you that if anything is penal at all, there's no recovery. That's the second and third elements of Cruz. But under the duty to defend in the insurance context, the result, the rule, is 100% the opposite. If there is any insurable element, then they had a duty to defend. Cruz is a backwards test used in a different context for specific purposes that do not apply here.
One quick question. If you were to prevail, is it a correct statement of the law that say you were reading the headline about 10th Circuit today decides, that type of headline? Is it correct that this case would read 10th Circuit decides that robocallers may shift the risk of any penalties or any payments to insurance companies?
I think the headline would be, Your Honor, 10th Circuit agrees with two other federal courts of appeals and three state Supreme Courts that a portion of the damages under the TCPA is compensable and not barred as a matter of public policy.
As a matter of analysis, you might be right. But you certainly don't understand journalism.
Well,
but that's not relevant to the decision we're making.
Judge McKay, I was going to say to Judge Lucero, I'm over time, and I'm not going to talk about what my credentials are here. I don't do media well.
Or my citizenship.
The one thing that's absolutely clear is that three of those five appellate decisions dealt with public policy exceptions, and each of the three says there is no problem as a matter of public policy with finding insurability of claims just like these.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counselor excused. Case is submitted. The next case this morning is Bailey v. Independent School District.